going to gavel the Jobs and Economic Development Finance and Policy Committee to order. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Nope, not quite there. But we are going to get started. We have a number of bills to go through today. We have pretty much mostly bonding bills and a couple of others. So I am going to call down House File 2337, Representative Rundgren.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon, Representative Rundbeck. Now, as I understand it, your bill will be referred to capital investment, correct?
Great. I think that would be the proper destination.
And I'm sure Representative Gunter would like to make that motion.
I do.
Thank you, Representative Gunter.
I move the House File 2337 be passed and referred to capital investment.
Correct. Just a sec, just a moment here, Representative Gunter. Apparently, we have new rules. It's going to just be re-referred to capital investment. And that's, I'm sure, your motion. So, having said that, we're moving on.
Lawyer.
Representative Rundbeck, if you would. Mr. Representative Mulley, could you move that chair? All right, we'll get somebody else. We're a lot more informal in this committee than the other committees to the page. So, if you'd like to present your bill.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee, for hearing House File 2337. This is a bipartisan bill, and it comes from the focus that's been directed for the last 3 years on the situation regarding White Bear Lake. The focus has been a concern of the DNR, the Met Council, the municipalities around White Bear Lake, as well as citizens, about the severe lake water drop, water level drop in White Bear Lake. And there's growing concern also about the drop in the groundwater aquifer levels, the Jordan Aquifer, and that's from the Met Council. So it's become a focus of a lot of folks, bipartisan, cities, etc. And ongoing studies do point to that there is perhaps too much use, overuse of the groundwater by the municipalities surrounding White Bear Lake. Those studies will continue to be done, but in the meantime, the city of Hugo, which lies just north of White Bear Lake and is a rapidly growing suburb and is 100% dependent on groundwater, that groundwater aquifer, is very interested in becoming less dependent. And the bill that they have would actually take a lot of the water they use for irrigation and treat it so that they don't have to rely on the groundwater. But I have Brian Baer here with me today. He's the city administrator. He also sits on the DNR's advisory team because of the groundwater management area project that's been set up with 50 cities around this area. But they can explain how their project works.
And who would like to go first? Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having us today. My name is Brian Baer. I'm the city administrator from the city of Hugo. With me today is Jay Kennedy. He's the city engineer for the city of Hugo. I'd like to give just a very brief overview, and then I'd pass it on to Mr. Kennedy to explain what the project is all about. This is a very important topic for us in Hugo. You should have some handouts that you have in your packet or being passed out to you. And as Mr. Kennedy gets started, he'll be walking you through just a few slides there. The issue that we all face in the Northeast Metro is one of water sustainability. That is the topic. We are at the focus of that conversation in the city of Hugo. There's a lot of things that are happening at the state level that are leading that discussion. The DNR has their big groundwater advisory team, the groundwater management area. We are a part of that. I sit on that task force as Representative Rundbeck had pointed out. We also serve on the Met Council's Water Supply Advisory Committee. The Metropolitan Council is studying water sustainability in the Northeast Metro. They're also looking at feasible alternatives to pumping of groundwater. What other options are available to us for a drinking water supply? It's an item that we're very concerned about, and we have been taking the lead, we think, in a whole host of ways to help conserve our water supply. We want to be good stewards of the aquifer in the city of Hugo. So there's a number of things that we've been doing in Hugo to make sure that we have a sustainable water supply for the future. We see it as an issue that affects our growth. We're an area that is being asked to grow by the Metropolitan Council. We see it as an economic development issue, and our access to clean drinking water obviously affects everything that we do. Our city council has asked us to adopt a philosophy in the city of Hugo. We are directed to reduce the amount of water that we're pumping out of the ground. We are directed to reuse the water that we have in the city that's available to us. So the water that we pump out of the ground, if there's a way to use it once and then recycle it, use it again, that's our objective. Secondly, we want to reuse the water, the rainwater that falls on our city. We don't want to let that water get away. We want to use it. And then finally, we want to replenish our water supply. So we want to let the water recharge back into the aquifer as much as we can possibly do that. So our city council has adopted that as a priority: reduce, reuse, and replenish. So we've done a variety of projects that go along that line. Today we want to talk to you about a very specific project. It's actually several projects all combined into one that will be what we call a stormwater reuse project. It will reduce our reliance on the aquifer. It will convert us to some degree over to surface water. A lot of the agencies, whether it's the Met Council or the DNR or the multitude of other groups that we're working with, are asking us to be more reliant on surface water and less reliant on groundwater. This is a project that will do that and help us conserve in other ways. And so with that, I'd turn it over to our city engineer.
Thanks, Brian. Excuse me, Mr. Kennedy, Chairman, members of the commission, thank you.
Mr. Kennedy, if I could just hold up for a moment.
Sure.
Because when I called this to order, we did not have a quorum. So now I will call it to order. And now it's official. So please identify yourself for the tape. I think you just did, and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Mahoney, members of the commission. Again, my name is Jay Kennedy, and I'm the city engineer for the city of Hugo. And Brian did a nice job of talking about the work that we've done in Hugo to not only conserve water, but to reuse water, which is, as Brian mentioned, a very important topic for our city council. I want to talk a little bit about water usage in the city, and in the packet I handed out, there's a pie chart that really shows how our water use is divided up. It's very common in communities in our metro area to have a similar percentage, but the thing that I would like the committee to take away is that between 40% and 50% of the water that we pump out of the ground is used for irrigation, either at people's homes on an individual single-family basis, by commercial and industrial uses, as well as homeowners associations or areas that have large common spaces that they irrigate. So the way that this is split up and what you can see on here is we have about 225 of our 425 million gallons that we pump out of the aquifer in a given year is used for domestic uses, drinking, showering, those types of things. About 100 million gallons is used by what we call our irrigation-only accounts. So let's say a homeowners association has a common space. They will only have a connection to our water system to irrigate. They won't use it for drinking or anything else. And so about one quarter of our use is for these irrigation-only accounts. That's a large number for us. The remainder is used by the typical single-family house where you might use your outside spigot, water your own lawn, things of that nature. So when we take a look at that, we see an opportunity because the one thing we have in Hugo is quite a bit of stormwater. In fact, four times as much stormwater leaves our city as we pull out of the ground. So about 4 billion gallons of water runs off, leaves our city in a typical year, and we see an opportunity to capture that. And so we've identified what we see as three projects that we can implement in a fairly straightforward manner. Just to back up a little bit, we do have one project like this that's already under construction, and we expect it to be online this spring. The Onika Ridge Golf Course in the city of Hugo used to rely on their own well to irrigate their golf course. They used about 35 million gallons of water per year. They pulled that out of the same aquifer that we do at the city, and then they used it to irrigate their golf course. Well, we've captured storm water, and that irrigation system will be online this spring. It's been converted. They will no longer need that well. Oh, they'll still have the well, but it's unlikely that they'll really need it. And we'll be able to use storm water to irrigate their golf course. So taking that lead as a city, we see a few opportunities that we have as well. We've identified those. There's a map in your packet. And really, without getting into detail on the map, there's a lot of dots on it. Those all indicate where connections are made to our water system to irrigate only. And so we've identified three different areas in our city, two subdivisions, and one is our own irrigation system for landscaping along County Road 8, which is the entrance into our city. Between those three accounts, about 54 million gallons per year is pumped out of the aquifer and used to irrigate those properties. So on the following map, there's a little bit more of an inset just as an example for the Water's Edge development. That's about a 400-acre subdivision, and quite a bit of common space is present within that subdivision. There's about 900 acres that drains through a drainage system right next to it. So it's the critical thing here is that we've got to have some water. The idea that a small stormwater pond that you might see next to a business could be something used for irrigation, it's not a practical situation. There's not enough water. So we've developed a means to evaluate that technically, and we believe we have enough water next to that development to now create a system with a pump and then some filtration, and then connect it to the various accounts within that subdivision, convert those common spaces to being watered using storm water. And there would be some operation and maintenance that goes along with that. The city would maintain the system, but not the irrigation heads and things of that nature. So what we're looking for is some support to implement that type of a system, because as you can imagine, when we remove 54 million gallons of water sales to our water utility, that is a loss of revenue. It's the strange situation that we find ourselves in. Good water conservation means less revenue. So we've estimated that over a 20-year period, if we converted these three areas, it'd be about $3 million in lost revenue. And we can certainly adjust our rates, but then that creates some economic development issues for us as well. We want to remain competitive with our water rates. So that is really an important factor for us. The last benefit that comes out of this is when we irrigate with stormwater, one of the things that we're able to do is promote some infiltration and groundwater recharge. And those do a couple different things. One is obviously to replenish the aquifers, but the second is to remove phosphorus from the water through the infiltration process. Phosphorus is what creates the issues in the downstream water bodies with the algae and some of the things that the watershed districts are very concerned about. So in summary, I've got just a few points to summarize. With the projects that we're talking about, we'd reduce our groundwater pumping by between 50 and 60 million gallons per year. We would reuse that 50 to 60 million gallons of storm water in place of that groundwater, and then we would also replenish the aquifer. A couple of statistics, we'd remove, we believe, up to 800 pounds of phosphorus annually. That's a large amount of phosphorus. It does not take much to create a lot of algae. We would free up capacity in our water system to be able to add an estimated 800 homes to our community without increasing the amount of water that we're pulling out of the aquifer today. So in other words, 425 million gallons that we're pulling today. By reducing that, we can add homes and still be at 425 million. And so that's a way for us to grow without increasing that strain on the aquifer. And then lastly, I mentioned the revenue that it becomes an issue for us, obviously. It's not the only driving factor, but it is something that we do need to pay attention to for our ratepayers.
Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. I'm going to open it up for questions. We've got about 3 or 4 minutes for questions. Otherwise, I've got a little comment, but after that, I'll. Any questions by the Representative Metzler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just more of a statement in general about water. I'd hope that we take all regions of the state's water issues very seriously moving forward.
Never, you know, an Iron Ranger will never bypass a shot to educate his colleagues. Mr. Kennedy, I don't live far from. That's not me. Oh, I guess it is me. That's what happens when the chair yells at people for having a cell phone on. I live close to White Bear Lake, so I've been somewhat involved in it, and I understand. I'm not as up on the water issues as some people are around here. So essentially, you're reducing the aquifer drawdown by 60 million gallons. Is this kind of commonplace coming in Hugo, Lionel Lake, you know, North Oaks, Forest Lake? You're all in that same boat out there, drawing water, I almost said money, from the aquifer. Now, I could be really unkind and just ship you over to the environment. But I'm not going to do that. I think this needs to go over to Bonnie. So are the other communities coming right after you with kind of requests for this type of a redo of their water systems in their towns? Do you know?
Mr. Chairman, do you expect them to be before you? Or are you just asking if they're looking at this type of concept?
I'm asking if they're looking at this type of concept, because if they are, they'll be coming to us for funding. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman and members of the commission, I would say that the city of Hugo is in a bit of a leadership position in the water reuse with water reuse. There are other examples in place. I mentioned the golf course that we have in Hugo. I believe there's a system in the city of Woodbury that has been looked at, and I know that the city of Matamidi, which borders White Bear Lake, is considering some water reuse concepts as well.
Oops, you know, I've got one other question. What would your water rates have to go up? I mean, you don't have access to the Public Facilities Authority, because that's pretty much a rural money's going out to Greater Minnesota to help rural Minnesota and their water issues. Of course, when somebody takes a shot, the Iron Range doesn't listen. How much are your rates going to go up if we don't do this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't have that right offhand. I would say, you know, one of the challenges is we have a conservation rate schedule. Mm-hmm. And so the less water that you use, the lower your rate is. And so as we get up into irrigation only, we charge a little bit more for that. What I can tell you is that through the three projects that we've highlighted, that represents about $140,000 annually. And so if you spread that out across everybody, we could do that calculation. But it is, you know, if you think about a 5 to 10% reduction in volume, you could expect that would probably be at least a 10% reduction in our rates, because it's the highest rate payers that we're taking out of our system.
It's too bad you can't get that low interest loan from the PFA. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kennedy, you just mentioned the conservation rate schedule. Can you give us a little more insight into how that works, please?
Yes, I can.
I mean, I know just for
Mm-hmm. The city of Hugo's water rates are such that there are three different tiers in terms of how much we charge per 1,000 gallons used. The lowest tier is our lower water uses. You would expect a typical single-family home, things of that nature would fall into that tier. That is our lowest rate per 1,000 gallons. I don't have that number right off. Do you know that number right off?
Roughly $1.50 per 1,000 gallons.
$1.50 per 1,000. Then there's a second tier. So then as you start to, as users start to use more water, they'll get charged that second tier. And then finally we have a third tier, which is also the rate we charge our irrigation-only customers, and that's $2.65 per 1,000 gallons. So these accounts we're talking about, that's what they're charged per 1,000 gallons for irrigation.
Quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quickly, I'm circling back to one of the comments you made earlier about raising your rates and the impact that it may have on your economic development. Do you connect any dots between the conservation rate structure and increased rates as a result of that with your business, some of your businesses, and economic development?
Thank you for that. In terms of the economic development side of things, access to clean water is obviously important, but also being competitive with not only our neighbors but the region in terms of being able to attract businesses and keep our businesses. You know, as we reduce that total revenue and need to increase those rates, let's say instead of $1.50 for that first year, now it needs to be $1.75, $1.80, we would lose our competitive, or at least be, you know, start charging more than maybe our neighbors. And then as businesses are looking to locate, that is sometimes a significant factor in their cost, is how much does it cost to get the water and the sewer for our business. And so that is a concern of ours.
It's a concern across the state, but we'll still have to deal with it. We're probably only partially in this particular committee, because water is becoming a scarcer and scarcer entity, and just wait till Arizona and Mexico and Utah keep coming up here looking for water out of Lake Superior, and they run into, I know, they're going to run into Canada, because the Canadian government won't let us. Mr. Kennedy, Mr. Bear,
right.
I appreciate your presentation today. I understand where you're at, and I want to commend you on your leadership on this particular issue. It's an issue that the whole of the northern suburbs are going to have to address sooner or later, and it's good that you're on top of it. So with that said, Representative Gunther renews his motion to re-refer to capital investment, House File 2337. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. You're on your way to capital investment. Thank you and good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And while Representative Ward is getting to the table for House File 2043, I'm going to make a comment that if we do a Senate office building, do you think we could get an air conditioning system in this room? Maybe? How about just all of our hearing rooms? I'm okay with the workout room. Workplace wellness is really important. I want to live to 90. I have a fixed benefit pension plan. Representative Ward, are you ready to go?
Mr. Chair, I am. Thank you. And
would you like to re-refer, move House File 2043 and re-refer it to capital investment?
I would do just that, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Representative Ward. What's Pequot Lakes got going on?
So, Mr. Chair, and members, thank you for hearing House File 2043 today on the Pequot Lakes wastewater treatment equipment bonding request. This bill would call for a $250,000 grant from DEED to the city of Pequot Lakes, and these funds would be used to replace irrigation equipment at the city's water treatment facility. Members, I know that Representative Uglum has been to Pequot Lakes, has been through there many times on his way to Walker. But Piqua Lakes is located about 20 miles north of Brainerd and Baxter area. Population of the city of Piqua Lakes, about 2,100 people. There's a two-lane Highway 371, which goes north of Brainerd up to towards Walker. Is a two-lane currently through Piqua Lakes City. That is going to be turned into a four-lane upcoming here. So Representative Uglum can get to his cabin a lot quicker. However, from a roadway perspective, Piqua Lakes does not receive any gas tax money for state aid cities of over 5,000 population. When the Highway 371 becomes a four-lane highway, it's going to take up about 6 miles of their city roadway. And into the city, and it's going to bisect their current wastewater treatment facility. Now, when we think of wastewater treatment facilities in most of our cities, we think of a substantial facility, concretes, pipes, things like that. What the city of Piqua Lakes uses is a wastewater spray irrigation field. They don't have a mechanical wastewater treatment plant. The city uses aerated ponds to treat the wastewater. And then after a proper amount of stabilization time, the water is sprayed irrigated onto crops. These pivot spray irrigators are an integral part of the city's wastewater treatment facility, just like pipes and other internal equipment in other wastewater treatment plants. These pivoted spray irrigators may be seen by some as equipment, but they're basically like discharge pipes from other wastewater treatment facilities. The pivot irrigators are part of the plant and not a piece of auxiliary equipment. And it is this spray irrigation field that is being bisected by the new highway. The city will have to, at a very minimum, relocate the three center pivot spray irrigators. Redoing the pipes, the pivots, the spray irrigators is estimated to cost about $500,000. This is a request of $250,000. The city knows it's going to have to contribute half, and they have started to save money towards that. This request then, but they can't pay the whole project. As a smaller city, the $250 request through deed will be greatly needed and appreciated. And as mentioned earlier, Piqua Lakes is not a state aid city. The city currently has about 35 miles of roadway. Six-mile roadway impacting is about a 15% increase in what is going to happen in the city of Pequot once with that wastewater treatment, once the new highway, four-lane highway, is put in. So we know that improvements are needed. The city has been saving the money, but the impact to Piqua Lakes far exceeds the city's capacity. Thus, we're asking for some help, thus the bonding request. Members, the city wanted to come down here and testify, and I said to them, you're going to go 4 hours, you're going to have a four-hour trip for a brief session, for a brief hearing. But this is really important to them. And so I feel very obligated to let you know that the city, in particular, really is pleading their case through me. So with that, Mr. Chair, members, I'll stand for questions as I can hopefully answer them.
Well, Representative Ward, has the city ever considered leaving the irrigators in place and charging people like Representative Uglum for car washes as they go by?
That's an intriguing thought, Mr. Chair. Representative Uglum's would be doubled, but that's an intriguing thought.
You've got a question.
Mr. Chair, no, just really kind of a comment. I think it would be entirely inappropriate for us to have a wastewater treatment wand going around the middle of the new Highway 371 and not only getting my car, but all the tourism that goes up 371. No, in reality, I think this is a very good project and obviously very needed, and 371 in the conjunction with this wastewater treatment facility obviously needs to be done.
Mr. Chair, I might add that it's going to a four-lane highway because of the for a couple different reasons, public safety being number one, as Representative Uglum can attest to, and then also just the capacity of the traffic has increased so significantly going through our area, which is great. We love that. Please keep coming. But we, you know, the roadway has to be increased just mostly for public safety.
And Representative Word, Representative Uglum is not the only one who goes up there.
Correct.
Question would be, is there going to be a bike path right next to it so I can stop riding on 371? Some of those tourists are not as kind of bikers as we'd like. Representative Speedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ward, I'm curious if this is a state DOT project, you know, the widening of the road and so forth, and the impact that's going to have on this spray irrigation field, why would there not be DOT funding to cover that part of the project?
Representative Ward.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, that's a great question. It is a DOT project along with some federal funds. It's been in the works for years. And it's been somewhat controversial just because, as you can imagine, and it's happened in a number of other cities around the state. Right now, you know, it goes the main 371 goes right through the middle of the Pequot Lake City. This is a sort of a bypass on the eastern side of the city. That being said, that's the controversial part of it, taken away from perhaps, you know, some of the businesses they feel not being accessible now through the new Highway 371. My understanding of why isn't MnDOT a MnDOT project? Because this is more of a equipment measure than a road measure, and I'm not sure that it would be eligible for MnDOT funding, but it is a question that I can check into.
Seeing no further questions, Representative Ward, would you like to renew your motion to re-refer House File 2043 to Capital Investment?
I so move, Mr. Chair.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Good luck in bonding.
Thank you.
Capital Investment Committee. I think you have another one.
I do, Mr. Chair. And members, this is House File 2040. Again, another critical project for my district and our area. And Mr. Chair, you visited the airport. I think it was we were having a jobs forum, I think. I don't think there's a capital invest. We actually visited with a capital investment committee as well. So a number of you have seen and heard about this project. The Brainerd Airport is a regional airport, beautiful airport. On the edge of Brainerd, on the eastern edge of Brainerd. It houses MnDOT area aviation. It houses State Patrol aviation. It houses emergency medical services, Life Flight, many, many critical components of our state aviation infrastructure, as well as, you know, commercial business, not big commercial business yet. We're working on that. We just had an upgrade of our terminal in the Brainerd Airport, and it's a beautiful, beautiful facility. But it is on a well and septic. When the airport terminal was examined by the state fire marshal, He passed the inspection with the caveat that the water and sewer be updated to city water and city sewer by the year 2016. There's some critical components. The most critical right now is the septic. We just were notified that the septic system at the Brainerd Airport has some problems, even with the upgrade. And you know what that leads to is some environment. You know, the Mississippi River runs right to the north of the airport, and some of you remember the Northwood project that we passed a few years ago there. And so, you know, from environmental concerns, we have some significant environmental concerns about the septic system at the airport. We also have along the roadway there, there are opportunities to expand economic development, big economic development, within the airport property itself and along Highway 210. And there are people just waiting to expand there if they had city water and city sewer. And we feel that this will really help job creation in our area if we were allowed to, you know, have that land with city water, city sewer, and thereby turning some commercial property development, economic development into that area.
That's the definition of that.
And there's a public safety concern. You know, I've heard from the fire chief and from the airport manager, from the city mayor, from the city council, from, you know, all folks associated with the Brainerd Airport, that you know, there's a public safety concern with, you know, a fire or some disaster that would occur, whatever. And in fact, would we have the capacity with our well and septic to take care of a disaster out there? So there's multiple reasons, good reasons, why we are asking for a 7.1 bonding project for from deed for the city of Brainerd, the funds to be used for Brainerd's water and sewer services out the Brainerd Lakes Regional Airport. With that, I'll stand for questions, Mr. Chair. I've got many more talking points, but you don't need to hear, I don't think, unless you want me to.
Well, thank you, Representative Ward. And I'm glad that you were kind enough to your constituents to warn them that they're only going to get 10 or 15 minutes
right
here for a four-hour, five-hour trip. I do have a couple of questions. One is there a city or county or airport match to this $7.1 million?
That's a great question, Mr. Chair. And right now, let me just get my notes here on that. Right now, there there is no specific financial match right now, but the airport manager has indicated that they would be looking at some FFA airport improvement plan funding to try to find a match for some of this. At this point, there is not a financial match for this project.
It's probably dependent on if we repay the $15 million to the... Could be.
Very likely, Mr. Chair.
Because that was my second question. What's the aviation fund doing for the airport itself, for improvement in the airport? So, and I understand. Representative Fabian, you had a question?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just as a follow-up, it was along the same line. I just wanted to know what was the total cost of the project.
$7.1 million. Yeah. There is a... Mr. Chair, if I may, you know, $7.1 million. There is... talk, and I think this is in somewhere else. There's a trail there. There's a cross, a clean area rec trail that there's a piece that's not connected to the Brainerd Lakes trail, Paul Bunyan Trail, that could be finished off for about another $350,000. But that's not in here right now. I think that's in a separate request somewhere else. So,
prolific bill writer.
Pardon me?
You are a prolific bill writer. But your area has a lot of needs.
Yes.
Representative Fabian, did that answer your question?
Thank you, sir.
Representative Metza.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say what a good job you do for your communities getting out there and knowing all these issues. I'm thoroughly impressed after watching you last year and this year know almost every detail about every bonding project that you brought forward on your own. So I look forward to learning my communities in the same fashion.
Thank you.
And I will comment this, that's a lesson that all freshmen and sophomores should learn. Because you never know when the other people won't show up.
So is it year two or term two for a sophomore?
In the case of some, it takes 3 to 6 years. Oh, I won't mention that we're going to. Representative Ward, see no further questions.
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'm dealing with. Thank you. To the author of the bill, I note in your testimony that MnDOT, number of emergency services, as well as the State Patrol, are included and would benefit from this initiative. I'm just curious as to what responsibility in terms of leasehold improvements they might be. Or feel obliged to pay for since they're using it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, that's a great question as well. And, you know, I don't know. They're paying right now, you know, for part of their lease agreement with the, you know, with the airport. And I don't know exactly that amount that they are contributing to, you know, to the operation of the airport. I do know that you know, I've been able and fortunate to be out there a number of times and see their individual operations, including the Lifeline, which is critical for not only our area, but for tourists that come up to our area and have a major catastrophe. We have a Lifeline that's bar none, some of the most excellent. Those services, I've been able to go up with the DNR and the DNR themselves and look at them, having them use their aviation programs for inspection of multiple AIS things or enforcement issues or whatever. The patrol also flies out of there for maybe for some speed issues. I'm not exactly sure, but they are. My understanding is they participate now in the financial obligation and will continue with that financial obligation as we move forward with this, is my understanding. What it is, Representative Albright, I don't know. So I don't know everything, Representative Metz, of each question, but I know that there's a financial obligation that they're willing to participate and help us with.
Representative Albright, follow up.
Thank you, sir. From a logistics perspective, in terms of, you know, hooking the airport up to city water and sewer,
mm-hmm.
obviously airports typically are a fair distance away from the municipality and locality and services of that nature. I'm just wondering if you can expand on what alternatives there might be to digging a trench that long. Is it a possibility to dig a deeper well or some type of a retaining tank or something like that? Has the municipality looked into those alternatives?
Mr. Chair,
Representative
Albright, my understanding is the city planner, Jeff Halsether, and the city themselves have been looking at all alternatives prior to the upgrade of the terminal, because they knew this was a concern and a problem. It's about a mile long. It's about a mile long extension, sewer extension, water extension. You know, along 210, and there are vacant. There are some vacant commercial property and vacant actual buildings along that line as well, as I mentioned before, that are ready to go. You know, if they can get city water, city sewer to there. So the alternatives that they've been looking for, my understanding is, you know, that this is the only alternative that will truly work for the capacity that they need. I don't know that. That's all. I don't know that there's other alternatives that will work for this.
Just one. Thank you, sir. In your testimony, you mentioned that the fire marshal passed the facility with a provision And was that a mandate or was it a recommendation?
Representative Ward.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, he signed off the inspection with the understanding that the terminal would have city water, city sewer by 2016. I'll leave that up to you to decide if it was a mandate or a...
Representative Albright, that's not an uncommon thing to do with some of these facilities, whether it's in the metro area or in Greater Minnesota. The building inspector will say, you know, this building is fine, but you have to put in the smoke detectors, or you have to put in fire sprinklers or new water or whatever, okay. By X, Y, and Z, because they know, particularly with municipalities and the financing. If it was just yours and my house, they probably just said, we're not going to pass it until you actually put it in. But they seem to trust cities more than they trust us.
Yeah.
I have just one final thought.
Go right ahead.
Thank you. From a standpoint of understand that the state has an important part to play in the overall health of that region of the state, as well as their usage of the facility. But I'm just wondering, from a standpoint of the county, what involvement they are willing or obligated to participate in this type of venture.
But, Mr. Chair, I'm glad you asked that. I have, and I didn't pass these out, I'm trying to save some trees, but I have a resolution of support from the county. I have a resolution of support from the city of Brainerd. I have a resolution of support from a township, and I also have, not with me, but I can show them to you when I come back to my seat and sit across from you, those three. And I also have a resolution, they're working on resolution of support from the chamber, from the Brainerd Lakes Chamber, and the Brainerd Lakes Area Economic Development Corporation. So the county has gone on record to support this project with the resolution support and whatever they can do to help get it passed.
Thank you, members. Seeing no further questions, Representative Ward, would you like to, I'll refer House File 2040 to the Capital Investment Committee.
I will.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Saying aye. Thank you. You're on your way to Capital Investment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
And members, we have 50 minutes left, and we have two bills. So if we go over 25 minutes, I'm going to cut it off at that. It's kind of a warning to Representative Dean as he comes down and to the members.
All right. All right.
Representative Dean, welcome to the committee. And I'm going to give you a heads up that there's likely to be an omnibus bill, and this will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Out of the Jobs and Economic Development. So as so will Representative right now.
Okay.
Please identify yourself and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members, for hearing the bill. The bill I have in front of you today is House File 2025, and it's a bill that would create a full employment initiative in targeted labor surplus areas. For those of you who can't quite grapple this notion of what is a targeted labor surplus area, it's an area that has high unemployment. So that's what's meant by a targeted surplus area. And what this bill would do is it would have the Commissioner of Deed establish a full employment initiative in these targeted labor surplus communities. And ultimately, community councils would form to work with the community, to work with other stakeholders in the area to develop plans to increase the employment for those individuals who are designated as, our disadvantaged communities, so communities of color and other areas. You can see in Section 2, it actually calls out in this section the cities that are defined within this clause that have a population of more than 60,000 and contain areas as labor surplus areas. And ultimately, part of what this is going to do is coordinated benefits for targeted vendors. Currently in section 16C.16, there's a 25% designation for small businesses within the state of Minnesota for vending and utilization of these small business areas. And we're asking that that be also be included in labor surplus areas, as well as in section 16C.16, subdivision 5, it does also designate targeted groups as such. The section C of subdivision 3 actually has the commissioner working with management budget and treasurers of each county to establish socially responsible investment programs within the financial institutions that they currently work with. And for those of you who don't know, the Community Reinvestment Act was put in place in 1977. Which has banks actually developing their plans to work in communities that are that fall within certain guidelines relative to the area median income to try to invest in those communities to empower them and to move them forward. So that's the gist of the bill. I have the Director of the Council on Black Minnesotans, Ed McDonald, here, who also would like to speak to the bill.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. McDonald. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Mahoney and members of the committee, Representative Dean. My name is Edward McDonald. I'm the Executive Director of the Council on Black Minnesota. I am grateful for the opportunity to speak to you today concerning House File 2025. I will keep my comments brief and will be happy to respond to any questions related to the bill. As you know, the Minnesota Legislature and Minnesota Statute 3.9225 empowered the Council on Black Minnesotans to ensure people of African heritage fully and effectively participate in, benefit from political, social, and economic resources, policies, and procedures of the state. Today, approximately 320,000 Minnesotans identify themselves as African heritage people. There are 76,000 immigrants living in Minnesota, representing 23 African nations. When the first significant number of African heritage people arrived in the Free State of Minnesota, they essentially had nothing. Today, Minnesotans of African heritage contribute strong cultural diversity, $3 billion in consumer spending. They operate 12,000 business enterprises with almost $1 billion in sales, employing 10,000 people, and generating annual payrolls of $258 million. They pay almost $500 million in state and local taxes annually. They also export nearly $200 million to African countries annually. They expected to generate lifetime earnings of an estimated $388 billion, with projected tax payments in Minnesota of $28 billion over their lifetime. We understand we can do better and want to do better to contributing to the great state of Minnesota. The Council, through its community engagement efforts, bring forth this community-driven legislation to help grow our community assets and to contribute more. This community-driven legislation move our state forward with new ideas, innovation, and energy that addresses the socioeconomic challenges that Minnesota face. This proposal take our community beyond constructs, simple tolerance, and appreciating diversity to practicing allophilia. Because of your policy work, Minnesota is beginning to enjoy the benefits of a solid economic recovery. We're all very proud of that fact. And the African heritage community is also beginning to feel the rising tide of the economic recovery in our communities across the state. However, we need a second-tier policy effort that sustains economic opportunity and career development in our communities. Mr. Chairman, during the Great Recession, our community slipped into a Great Depression. While things are improving to recession levels in our community, during the economic downturn, the African heritage community in Minnesota experienced the highest rate of unemployment in the nation, the highest percentage of a population group living in poverty, a 16% drop in the median household income. We lost a tremendous amount of home ownership wealth. Mr. Chairman and committee members, House File 2025 requires the Commissioner of Deed to establish a full employment initiative in targeted labor surplus communities within the limits of current appropriations. We believe this is the Minnesota way and the right thing to do. Most Minnesotans of African heritage live in labor surplus communities. Any investment prescribed, as prescribed in House File 2025, targeted labor surplus communities will result in increased employment, careers for individuals in those communities, and redevelopment initiatives that revitalize those areas. House File 2025 helps grow and sustain prosperity that will buffer the communities if the next downturn in the economy occurs. House File 2025 will increase the tax-based contribution from those communities, which in turn benefit the state through increased revenues and lower public assistance. Therefore, I humbly urge you to vote in favor of House File 2025 and recommend this approval to the full House. I'm confident that this bill will allow Minnesota to take a giant step in ensuring prosperity reach and is sustained in all of this great state's communities. Thank you for your support, and I'm prepared for any questions you may have.
Mr. McDonald, thank you so very much. Representative Dean, did you have any comments before I open it up for questions?
Mr. Chair, no, let's go ahead and go to questions.
Representative Slavik, you had
a
question. Yeah,
I have a question on this. I think this is a great bill as far as helping people go forward. But I'm looking at it, and it says populations of 60,000 residents. And I just wanted to make the point that there is a lot of labor, excess surplus labor in greater Minnesota, and we do need jobs out there, too. Mm-hmm. So I don't really support a special bill for a certain part of the state. I think we need to look at the whole state in order together and make sure that everybody has an opportunity for jobs.
I don't think that was a question.
No,
I'm going to move on to Representative Norton, unless you have something that you wanted to comment on.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative. In fact, part of the design of this is modeled after an initiative that DEED has for rural communities in outstate for populations under 50,000.
Okay.
Representative Norton.
Yeah, Subdivision 3 talks a lot about community councils, and I'm not familiar with what a community council is or if any of these communities have one or how that gets established, and so if somebody could explain community council to me.
I will actually defer to Mr. McDonald here.
Chair Mahoney, Representative, the metropolitan area has a lot of experience with community councils. The city of Minneapolis, for example, have what they call neighborhood improvement districts, 82 of them in the city of Minneapolis. The city of St. Paul, under Mayor Latimer, in the mid-70s established, I believe, 17 district councils. My community of Oakdale has a city council. I wouldn't be eligible for this program, but it's a smaller community on the size of a district council in St. Paul. The council concept is not anything new to Minnesota. In fact, most communities around the country have moved to community council planning concepts in order to be more exact about how they deploy socioeconomic development activities within local communities.
And they are a blessing and a curse. A blessing when they're on your side and a curse when they're not. Representative Norton, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I do. So this is in addition to, in a community the size of Rochester, we have our city council. We're a town of just over 100,000. So you're saying in addition to our city council, there would be other councils that would be developed? And how many per capita, or how do you decide that?
I'm just going to, Representative Dean?
Well, I mean, if you look at Subdivision 2, it actually sort of spells out it means a locally appointed authority comprised of residents and stakeholders from targeted labor surplus areas as defined by United States Department of Labor. So your city council wouldn't be the same as a community council. The city council or the mayor would appoint a group of stakeholders that would become part of this group that would help to oversee and work with DEED on implementation of this.
So, Mr. Chair, if I could just continue. Yeah, well, I'm just trying to understand this. So our city council might appoint a community council. I'm assuming there would only be one, but it sounds like there's 82 or something in Minneapolis, which is one of the targeted areas. So do all those community councils in Minneapolis then qualify as a community council with respect to this, or would it be a specific one just to deal with this issue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, so the city of Minneapolis actually has 87 neighborhoods, and I believe they have 82 different neighborhood organizations, but they also have what's called the neighbor NCRC. It's a body that's appointed that sort of oversees all of the neighborhood organizations. So that group would then designate a group of stakeholders that would fulfill this role instead of having 87 different organizations.
And Representative Norton, my suspicion is with this, so in St. Paul, the district council that I live in has 40,000 residents in its particular area, and it would fit underneath these particular parameters. So that they would ask that council to work with any particular jobs going on in their particular physical boundaries. The one next door has 30,000. Is the same deal. One next door to that would not fit underneath this because it doesn't have the unemployment nor the minority population. So it would almost be a spot by spot. Now, I suspect there's places in Minneapolis that would not come underneath this. I could name a few, but I'll just get myself in trouble with your new mayor, and I won't do that.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, because this is something new, and it's, at least from my perspective, this is going to be new for my community, and I suspect for a lot of the others, perhaps not Minneapolis and maybe not St. Paul here. Could we get a little bit more information? I can just see the community council issue taking a while to get going in communities. Is there a way if
Representative Norton,
whoever has this information could get more information to me about community councils?
I'll tell you a story. When I was a freshman and I was in the minority, I made it a point, if I had a decent bill that I thought needed to go somewhere, I made it a point to go and talk to everyone that was going to have to vote on it in a committee. I'm sure Representative Dean would love to sit down with you and give you a full vetting of what this would do and how it would happen.
Representative Dean, would you come visit me in my office, please?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes.
Are you done, Representative Uglum? We've got about 12 minutes, and then we're going to move on to Representative Clarksville.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this piggybacks a little bit on Representative Savick's questions. Because I have in front of me from the website the U.S. Department of Labor, which defines the surplus areas as only Clearwater County and Kennebec County. So I'm a little confused here. We have metro cities that are listed here, and, Hennepin County right now has unemployment rate overall of right around 4%, where some of these outstate counties like Clearwater County have unemployment rates at 12.3%. So, it says on 1.14 in the bill that locally appointed authority comprised of residents and stakeholders from targeted 1.5 surplus areas as defined by the United States Department of Labor. And their website shows only Clearwater County and Kennebec County, which makes sense when you look at the unemployment rates. And then when we talk about cities of 60,000 residents, well, I know for a fact there's nobody in those counties, no city that's going to compare to that. And if you look at unemployment, and Representative Savick, you're entirely correct, outstate unemployment now in some of these counties, like, well, Crow Wing County, 7.6% Aiken County, the same CAS 9.2. So I guess I have a problem with the definition, and I'm questioning why affluent areas like Bloomington and Burnsville and cities like that are called out when they don't meet the qualifications of the Department of Labor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bugler, I'm not sure where you got that on the Department of Labor, but I understand your concern. And one of the things that we're targeting here also is, you know, communities of color that often tend to have higher unemployment. The number that you quote for Hennepin County is very different than the number if you take a few neighborhoods in Minneapolis. And if you also break apart that number based on the demographics of individuals. So, for instance, in the African-American community, unemployment rate is still close to 8 or 9%, if not higher, when you consider other types of, you know, localizing that for North Minneapolis or for some parts of central Minneapolis. So I think the numbers around unemployment is an important thing, and ultimately, you know, the issue of the United States Department of Labor being defined by that, I would have to look into that more to, you know, say why what you're looking at is different than what this is.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Dean, just so you know, we all get the reports from the unemployment division from the state, and good, better, and different, we've been forcing ourselves to try to figure out how you read those statistics, and some people are better than others.
Sure.
And his numbers are right. Representative Uglum's numbers are correct. There's 16 counties with 2 points higher than the seven-county metro area in greater Minnesota. There are some that are lower, 2 points lower than those. And now yours and Representative Gunther's. he's over there. So, again, you've got some work to do on this particular bill. And I don't disagree that our minority communities have, for those of us who have looked at the numbers, the minority communities, not just African-American, but Latino and Hmong and a variety of others in our East African
American Indian, American Clearwater,
Indian, have been bypassed by our recovery in this state. There's some good things in this bill. Mm-hmm. There's some things that probably have to be massaged and worked on. And hopefully we can do that. We have about 5 more minutes, and we have 3 more people. Albright, Newton, and Clark. You each get about a minute and a half. All right. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if, as in the case of Coon Rapids, and Representative Uglum forgot to mention that as being one of the affluent areas. But I think maybe in Champlin also that you have the Economic Development Council and you have the Housing Redevelopment Council or Commission. That's actually the City Council itself that sits there. So is this sort of what you're looking at, is having the city councils in some of these communities act in this capacity as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Newton, this bill would actually have a new group that forms, and it would work with those agencies at the city council or the housing, the redevelopment authority.
Yeah, I don't want that. No, it's just...
ask for chocolate when he comes talk
to you. Yeah, yeah, please come and talk to
you. You had a question.
Well, I think it's partially been answered, but I just point out, first of all, I want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. Really appreciate it. And one of the things to note here is that they're talking about areas within cities. I can tell you some of our neighborhoods, for example, Representative Mahoney and I and Representative Dean, we probably have more people in our little neighborhood than in 2 or 3 or 4 counties put together. I know that's true. So counties aren't really what's being addressed here. It's areas designated within cities, and that's where the unemployment is.
Representative Dean, there's no other questions, so I'm going to move that this be laid over because we'll probably be doing an omnibus bill yet here. The intention is good. It's got a little bit of work to do. I'm happy to work with you and try to figure it out. because this has some, it has some value in how we treat the people who have been missed by our recovery. We're all fair. I don't care which side of the aisle we're on. We all want the best for all of our, the people that we represent and the people that live in the state. And this may or may not be the way to go, but it might be a way to start. So, any closing comments before I lay the bill over for possible inclusion?
Well, I just want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. You know, I will never profess that the bill I bring to my first committee is perfect. So I certainly know that there'll be some work that will be done, and I know there are a few members I'll have to sit and have a conversation with, so thank you.
Wait a minute. This is your first time in this committee?
I forgot to bring cookies. My apologies.
Oh, snap.
We vote on the bill.
Wow. Mr. McDonald, I want to thank you for your statements and your concern about this this bill and this issue. As again, not only just the African-American community or the East African or any other community, we have problems in all of our communities that have been missed by this recovery, and I appreciate the effort that you're putting forth, and I'll work with Representative Dean to try to figure out if there's some way we can make this happen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I'm sorry that the bill may have been interpreted as a selfish request by the African Heritage community, but it is a bill that looks at anyone within a targeted labor surplus community that is challenged by not benefiting from the economic recovery. We bring this forward, and we're very serious about it. These are human beings that want to be a part of the American dream, and we appreciate any consideration you give to a very innovative approach to getting that. We live this experience, and we just want to get a handle around it. In Rochester, in Eden Prairie, in St. Paul, and even my community of Oakdale. So it's intended to serve all Minnesotans.
Thank you, Representative Dean. So, one moment here. Representative Gunter, did you have a comment?
I do. I encourage this bill and encourage ideas that this bill will bring to us. We are heading for a definite labor shortage in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. We need educated workforce. We need a workforce that can grow. And in these neighborhoods you're talking about is where the challenge truly is. So I think if we're going to continue to grow and prosper as a state, we have to include you.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Representative Clark, I think you're up next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move House File 2254. I'm guessing that it'll be laid over. And so we have a chance to present the bill to you today.
Representative Clark, until I get a target, my intent is to lay your bill over for possible inclusion. I don't know if we're going to get a target. We'll find that out over the next week or two. So thank you for bringing your bill forward. And looks like you have a couple of tests. Looks like you have a couple of testifiers. If you want to say a few words, we've got about 20 to 25 minutes.
We'll stick to that timeline. Thank you. So I'm just going to say a little bit about the bill. It is a small business incubator initiative, and it's, as some of you know, small business incubators, they have a very positive track record of ensuring success for little startup businesses. And this bill makes capital improvements to five existing incubators and would establish an acquisition development fund to assist in the creation of new incubators and target some increased services at businesses located in those existing incubators that need some help. I have Mr. Tamale here from the Neighborhood Development Center who's going to talk about how this works on the ground, and so I'm going to just turn it over to them and we can come back for questions, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
My name is Mike Tamale. I'm the CEO of the Neighborhood Development Center. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for taking time to listen to our presentation. What we're seeking right now is some support for five different business incubators that we currently operate with 120 small entrepreneurial businesses inside of them. They're all located in the inner cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. We're also seeking support for a little bit of funding to take on another one or two such projects. We're currently operating a pretty expansive entrepreneur training and financing program all over Minneapolis and St. Paul, but also now out in Eden Prairie, Brooklyn Center, Hopkins. This involves extensive entrepreneur training. It involves, and this training, by the way, happens in five languages, either for low to very low income folks that want to start their own business, about 82% persons of color. The financing that we do involves microfinancing and what we call second stage financing, so it's up to $250,000 of financing. We use SBA funding for that. We use deed funding for that, and Treasury Department, U.S. Treasury Department funding for that. So your support last year of deed and their request for the Urban Initiative Program as well as the Emerging Entrepreneur Fund was greatly appreciated. We were able to tap into that for some of the funds we need to do this work. Where all of our work comes together with the highest impact is in our five different business incubators. These are it's kind of a hybrid model. It's a combination of for-profit and non-profit elements that are in a hybrid model. It has dual goals of both community development and also business development. The community development elements are that typically what we're taking on are empty older buildings, like the old Swedish Bank building on Payne Avenue, like the old Sears Tower on Lake Street and Chicago Avenue, etc. The properties at University and Dale and St. Paul, and renovating them or building new so that you have a visual catalytic impact right away with the renovation. Then we fill those buildings with entrepreneurs from the neighborhood who we've trained and financed. That inspires other people in those communities to start their own businesses very often, or at least look into taking our class or other classes. Crime goes down demonstrably as soon as these projects open, spin-off investment happens around these projects. So from a community development, nonprofit, public purpose point of view, these are very powerful projects, high visibility, high impact. On the business side of the ledger, like I say, we currently have 120 businesses in these five buildings. They pay market rate rent. They pay back their loans. They pay their rent. They get evicted if they don't. They get foreclosed on it if they don't. This is an absolute normal kind of way of doing business. An awful lot of these folks start in our incubators as startups, and the idea is that they grow and expand and maybe start second or third locations, add jobs, etc. We currently have about 360 jobs in these five buildings. What we like to do is get to a point where we can hand off these projects to other organizations. Recently we handed off the Swedish Bank building on Payne Avenue to our partner group on Payne Avenue, the Eastside Neighbor Development Company. There's over $5 million a year paid in sales and income tax by the entrepreneurs that we're working with across the board, and these five buildings just alone pay over $350,000 in property taxes. The funding we're seeking right now would do three things. Number one, it would bring some capital improvements to some of these buildings because they all can use that, and the rent that's paid by these tenants is market rate. Like I said, it covers the actual business side of the equation. Tends to not always cover the nonprofit or public entrepreneurial development side of the equation. So that's one thing we're seeking. Secondly, we're seeking some funds to develop additional business incubators, and we're looking particularly at the east side of St. Paul and the north side of Minneapolis. But we've had requests, including out in Eden Prairie, for taking a look at a project there. And then third, we're looking for some support for the training and the business assistance that we provide to these entrepreneurs, which includes a lot of marketing work with their business branding and social media marketing. It includes financial management, a lot of that, and cross-cultural customer service training, etc. So those are the three things we're seeking. We've asked one of our entrepreneurs, Thomas Kim, to come today, and he's here next to me, and he's the owner, along with his wife, Kat, of the Rabbit Hole, which is a new, already highly acclaimed restaurant inside the Global Market, and they came off a smaller stand at the Global Market, and we've asked him just to talk just briefly about his trajectory with his wife and his new three-month-old baby in business.
Mr. Kim, welcome to the committee, and you look surprisingly well, for better than somebody I know that had a just recently have been going through that 3-month, 4, 5, 6-month-old baby stuff.
Oh, yes. Thankfully, she's been very, very easy to manage, so I think that my wife would attest differently. So, good afternoon, Chairman and committee members. I just wanted to just come forward and just really, support what NDC is really trying to do, and whatever I can do to kind of enlighten the committee as to what benefits is provided. NDC provided me specifically with forms of non-traditional funding, access to business advice. I have had the opportunity to go to several of their small business classes, which was very, very helpful in creating our first business, which was the Left-Handed Cook at the Midtown Global Market. And for myself, I've actually only lived in Minneapolis for just under 2 years. And through NDC support, I was able to open 2 successful businesses. And, you know, without their help, I would definitely not have been able to do that. The great thing about it is that the benefits that it provides, just even from what I've seen to the neighborhood specifically, is great. The jobs that we provide, we have 22 full-time employees. We have 12 part-time employees, 80% of which are all from the neighborhood itself. I actually live within the neighborhood, and so it's always encouraging to see, reinvestment into the neighborhood and growing within that community. The support that I've gotten through NDC and from NDC in regards to operating our business has been tremendous. And through kind of the guidance of Jeff Alexander, who is the director of the Midtown Global Market, we've been able to transition from a small stall into a 140-seat restaurant.
So thank you, Kim, or Thomas, rather. Another of the entrepreneurs we were going to feature today, he had an issue at the last moment, but the Grooming House at University in Dale is owned by 2 young African-American barbers, and they've gone from just their own 2 chairs to having a total of 10 chairs that are full pretty much constantly, and they now want to expand, double their size, and double the number of chairs that they have, and they're from the Frogtown neighborhood. It's that kind of person that not only creates jobs and pays taxes and payroll, but also inspires their neighbors, their family, and their neighbors to consider the same path. Again, these incubator buildings are the places where we can feature these entrepreneurs most prominently in their own community, where they're most visible and thus most catalytic, but also where we're the most cost-effective in our training and our technical assistance, because they're all under one roof. So, the Mercado Central, Lake and Bloomington, 47 Latino entrepreneurs. They've been open 14 years now. It's been a whole lot easier for us to do the training in Spanish for them, how to pay their sales tax online, how to comply with health inspector regulations, whatever it may be, under one roof, do joint marketing under one roof, and give all 47 of these entrepreneurs a chance to support their own family and grow their business. And many of them have started second and third locations. In fact, Tortilla La Perla came out of the Mercado Central, opened a second location on Payne Avenue at Sims, the old body shop behind the, right next to ESNDC, and then started a $1 million factory in the Seward neighborhood of South Minneapolis, where they're now expanding from two lines to three lines, shipping tortillas all the way to Chicago and selling them in Walmart. So there's a real strong track record of these folks expanding. Sonora Grill is featured in the article we just passed out. They went from a small stall at the Global Market, again with a lot of support from the incubator, to having their own location on Lake and 34th, I believe. But again, 20 or 30 employees filled a vacant Embers, I believe. Salty Tart is up for their fourth James Beard nomination. This was a single mother of two that started at the Global Market and was able to basically walk into a bakery equipped with what she needed for the most part and take her incredible talents and put them right to work in spite of not having a lot of upfront capital or business, sort of backroom business expertise. So those are just a few examples of what the incubators can do, and we'd like to do more of these, but we also need to stabilize the ones we have a little bit. So thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Tonelli. Question I have for Representative Gunther. Didn't we do something like this in last year's bill for areas down in your neck of the woods?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we did. I very much used this model as the model I chose to use for the one for Greater Minnesota. Is for minority-owned businesses, entrepreneurs, and they have both the Southern and the Southwestern Initiative Fund economic development people helping them get started with business plans and so forth. So I learned a lot from you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And I will have you help me judge how well they did next year.
I'll be down.
Representative Metzen, you had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I again would applaud you for your work on this. I think it's great. I would love to copy and paste that. Maybe this is a possible idea for Representative Dean to include in expanding this out to a full statewide program. But I am hesitant to pick and choose as government, you know, what we're going to be investing in. And so I think that it would be, well, I just set you up, so. But
I'll have the IRRB.
It's property tax money. Yeah. So I guess the basic thing is, you know, I'd like to see this expanded outside the metro area and continue the work, and I'd hope that you know, we could meet and discuss potentially wrapping it in some way, shape, or form to get something up in northern Minnesota for Representative Fabian and I. He does consider me central. That's kind of goofy.
Mr. Chair, I think, I feel like that bill's being loved to death. I like that, and maybe there's a way we can, if we can put enough funding in. I mean, it is a very viable model, and it's so exciting to see the kind of jobs that come out of this and the prosperity. So if this committee likes it and we can at least take care of the existing models and ones that are aging and need a little bit of help, maybe we could talk about, and that is part of this bill, to do some expansion. Maybe it can be even broader.
So, seeing no other questions, I have one other comment. Mr. Tamale or Representative Clark, did you go through the competitive grant program last year?
Yes, so last year we sat here and Representative Mullery had put out a bill with our name on it, and I sat here and said, you know, spoke in support of it, obviously, because it had our name on it, but at the same time, I was also saying we're supportive of the deed competitive pool. And what happened at the end was that the bill with our name on it was pulled, and we just went into the competitive process at deed, and it worked out just fine.
You were awarded?
Yep. Yep. We were somewhere around 180,000 for this kind of work. And just to be clear again, the entrepreneur training that comes first, then the lending, then the technical assistance, these are all programs we do all over the metro area. These five incubators are particular buildings where we can load that type of service in, a little heavier, more cost-effective. But it's also, you know, it's a real estate project at the same time. Mm-hmm. So we do our entrepreneur training, lending, and TA in places where folks have to go get their own building also.
And one final question, then I'm going to lay this bill over. I take it that the businesses that you deal with also take out private bank loans. Is that
yes.
correct?
Yep.
Okay. And a percentage of the businesses, 10%, 100%?
You know, on day one, 10% maybe. But you go back 2 years later, it's probably pushing 30-40%. You think of a whole ladder, you know, we get them on the first rung usually just with our own money and their own money. But a rung up, maybe a bank will do 30-40%. We might do 30-40% in the second position. Mm-hmm. And then maybe the third rung, they're on their own with the bank. Okay. And it doesn't always work that smooth, but often it does, very often it does. And there's a considerable bank loan in the Rabbit Hole restaurant and in the Sonora Grill. So the examples we're giving you, they typically, when they get to that level, they're doing, they attract bank financing in addition to our subordinated financing.
Thank you. Representative Clark, any final closing statements? Or?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your consideration.
We'll lay this bill over for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
Kim, thank you. And I have not yet tried your restaurant, but my wife will get me over there to try it, I'm sure.
Please do. Thank you so much.
I don't know that I've gone to the same restaurant twice other than our first date restaurant in 12 years. So. Remember, we have, before we leave, that final bill for the day, we have from February 27th. And Representative Fabian, have you taken a look at
them?
I think you were stopped over here to say something.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to make one short amendment to the minutes just to make sure that my name is listed as present.
Okay.
We talked about venture capital and so forth.
We will make that adjustment, adding Representative Fabian to the members present. I will further move that names Purcell and Leidiger be added to those minutes. So in total, the amendment would be Purcell, Leidiger, and Fabian as amended. All those in favor of the approving the minutes of February 27th as amended, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Minutes are done. We are done. Thank you so very much.